Hi, welcome to VLectures. We are on chapter 12, in which we are going to understand more details on a bank customer. In the previous chapter, we saw who a customer is and who a consumer is. For being a customer, you need to open a bank account. Whereas for being a consumer, you can take any casual service, which can be in the form of purchase of a demand draft, exchange of foreign currency into a local currency. And we have seen the importance of establishing a relation between a banker and a customer, and this relationship is in the form of a contractual agreement. And when we say a contractual agreement, we need to understand the different types of customers. When we say different types of customers, we are categorizing the customers into two main branches. On one side, we have the customers representing the individual category, whereas the other side represents the non-individual. If you and me want to open an account, we will be called as an individual. There are special types of individuals, like a minor, like a married woman, like a pradhanizin woman, like a illiterate person, like a visually challenged person. Based on the constitution or based on the type of customer you are, the banker has to ask you to fulfill certain terms and conditions which will make you eligible to enter into a contract of banking with the banker. Same way, if we have to consider the examples of non-individual, most of the non-individuals are not natural persons, which means they are artificial persons. They have been considered as a legal entity on the basis of fulfilling certain terms and conditions prescribed under the law, like companies have to fulfill certain conditions mentioned under the Companies Act 1956. Partnership firms have to fulfill the conditions mentioned under the Indian Partnership Act. Same way, the trust, the societies, the clubs, the schools, the colleges, everybody will be called as a non-individual entity, but they can avail all the banking services offered by a banker only after fulfilling certain terms and conditions. You got a clarity of who a customer is in the previous chapter. This chapter is going to help you to understand the various types of customers a bank has, and it will also advise you on issues you should be aware of while dealing with these different types of customers. So let's begin with chapter 12, which will throw light on various aspects of bank customers. Why do we need to know various types of customers? What is the necessity of knowing various types of customers? Deposit accounts can be opened for those persons who are legally capable of entering into a valid contract. If a banker allows anybody to open an account who are not legally capable of entering into a contract, the contract becomes void from the very beginning. The banker cannot sue any person who has entered into a void contract. So the basic protection from the law of contract can be availed by a banker only and only if he enters into a contract with those persons who are legally capable of entering into a valid contract. Such customers, for becoming a customer of the bank, has to accept the terms and conditions of the banker. It's simple. Bank gives an offer, and only after the offer is accepted by the customer, it becomes a formal contract. Hence, number one requirement is legal capability. Number two requirement is such eligible person needs to accept the terms and conditions of the banker. Account cannot be opened in the name of those persons who are not competent to enter into a valid contract, like a lunatic. Who is a lunatic? A person of unsound mind. An unsound mind is not capable of taking his own decisions. How can he be capable of entering into a contract? He is not legally capable of entering into a contract, and hence cannot open an account in his name. Can he avail of any banking services in spite of being a lunatic? This is all we are going to understand as we go through this chapter. Some persons who act on behalf of others have limited powers to contract, like the agents, the trustees, and even a natural guardian of a minor. In case of a trust, the trust cannot come to the bank on its own. It has no hands or legs for its own, and hence it appoints certain trustees to do the day-to-day affairs of banking on behalf of trust. But then the trust can decide upon what type of activities can be performed by a trustee on behalf of a trust or any other, or by any other authorized person of the trust. This comes to the third point of some persons who can act on behalf of others have certain limited powers, and such powers can also be mentioned in a power of attorney, which can be of a general nature or a specific nature. So we are also going to touch upon these aspects to understand these exceptions. When it comes to individual accounts like you and me, we are very clear as to what documents we need to submit for opening an account and entering into a contract with a bank. But when it comes to your impersonal accounts or the non-individual accounts like those of the schools, colleges, clubs, societies, corporate bodies, the requirements will definitely change. It will vary from those of the individual accounts. And how are we going to understand whether the persons who are authorized to operate the banking account are indeed eligible for availing such powers conferred upon them? This is a special requirement And a banker has to carefully see this. And from where is he going to see that? The document will be based on the constitution of that impersonal entity. The authority, powers, and functions of the persons managing these institutions are embodied in their respective constitutions. Like the schools, colleges, clubs, and societies will have their own bylaws, which will have, in addition to the rules and regulations, it will clearly make a mention of who can have what sort of powers to operate the bank account, which type of transactions can be performed based on the authority or the instructions given by the managing committee. And hence, it is very essential for a banker to minutely go through this bylaws and then decide whether to allow such persons to avail of those powers and the functions granted on them by the managing committee. Only then the banker has performed his duty correctly for allowing the person to open an account and enter into a banking relationship. How will we be able to do this? Only when we understand the requirements of each and every entity, and that's what we are going to study in this chapter. The banker should take special care and precautions to ensure that the account of these institutions are being conducted in accordance with the provisions of their respective charters. What are the various types of customers a bank deals with? Now here we have a mix of both individuals as well as non-individuals. Most of this constitute the individual customers, which includes a minor, an adult, a senior citizen, a married woman, a Pardhanisin woman, an illiterate person, a disabled person, a lunatic, a drunkard, and a visually challenged person also. A category of customer includes your insolvents, your non-residents, persons of Indian origin, overseas citizen of India, foreigners can also open an account with Indian banks, the trustees, the executors and administrators, the customer's attorney to the power of attorney, joint accounts also. Then we have special cases of joint Hindu family, the sole proprietorship, the partnership firm, the joint stock companies, and finally the clubs, societies, and the charitable institutions. Now let's begin with the first category of individual customer, and that is a minor. Who is a minor? As per Indian Majority Act 1875, a person who has not completed 18 years of age will be called a minor. It's not you and I decide who is a minor. It has been specifically provided in the Indian Majorities Act 1875 that a person who has not completed 18 years of age will be called a minor. Have you heard somebody who has completed 18 years of age but has not completed 21 years of age be called a minor? Yes, if a minor has a court-appointed guardian, he remains a minor till he completes his 21st year. So we have two categories in minor. The Indian Majority Act mentions a person who has not completed 18 years of age as a minor, whereas if a minor has a court-appointed guardian, then he will be considered as a minor till he completes his 21st year. We have a very famous case in the form of Mohri Bibi versus Dharamdas Ghosh. In this, a very important issue was touched up, and it was on the basis of Indian Contract Act 1872. A minor was declared as not capable of entering into a valid contract. So if you as a banker are going to directly open an account for a minor, the very contract will be considered as a void, an illegal contract, and the basis for this would be this Mohri Bibi versus Dharamdas Ghosh. A contract entered into by a minor is void from the start. A contract for supply of necessities of life to a minor is, however, a valid contract, but such accounts has to be opened by a natural guardian of the minor, and certain requirements has to be fulfilled by even the natural guardian. A minor may repudiate his promise or consent. If a banker opens a saving account, but by no way he can open a current account, a banker may open a saving account under these two scenarios in the name of a minor, but the account would be operated upon by the natural guardian or guardian appointed by a court, or in the joint names of two or more minors, again to be operated upon by the guardian. This is a special category, the second part. Bank can open a saving account in the name of a minor to be operated upon by himself only if he has attained the age of 10 years. So some of the banks keep 10 years as the base limit, whereas some of the banks raise this limit from 10 years to 14 years, 12 years, based on their rules and regulations. But in no way a minor below 10 years can open an account by himself. He has to open an account in his name, but operated by the natural guardian. What are the precautions that has to be taken by a banker in case of minor's account? The banker must obtain the birth of date of the minor and record the date of birth of the minor as given by the minor or his guardian on the basis of valid document like his municipal birth certificate. On the attainment of majority, the account of the minor no more remains as an account of minor because he has attained the age of majority. What is to be done? In such cases, the account needs to be closed and the balance paid to the minor. In case of the joint account, the minor is also permitted to operate the account, and his signature should be taken on the account opening form after he attains his age of majority. Banker has to take instructions from the guardian for operating such minor accounts. If a father of a Hindu minor dies, what is to be done? His mother becomes his natural guardian. After the death of the mother also, what can happen during the minority of the boy? There is either a testamentary guardian, which means a guardian appointed by the will, or the guardian appointed by the court. And finally, if the minor dies, what happens? The balance can be withdrawn by the guardian. So we have to understand these different scenarios which can arise whenever we open a minor account. If at all an overdraft is created in a minor's account, what legal remedy can a banker have? The banker will have no legal remedy, no risk till the account is not overdrawn. But if an overdraft or an advance is granted, even by a mistake or unintentionally, the banker has no legal remedy to recover the amount from the minor. What happens in case of a pledge, which means loan given on the basis of deposits or securities? Pledge created on the assets of the minor are also not valid. A guarantee given by a third party for granting an advance to a minor is also not valid. So overall, the banker has no legal remedy against an overdraft or a pledge or a guarantee given on behalf of a minor. Section 128 of the Indian Contract Act 1872 is very important for understanding the liability of a surety is coextensive with that of a principal debtor. What does this mean, and how are we going to make use of it to understand from the banking point of view? Since the contract between the creditor, that is a bank, and the principal debtor, that is a minor, itself is void, a minor cannot take upon the liability upon himself. And hence, the liability of surety, which is coextensive with that of principal debtor, will hold no good. The surety's liability does not arise if the liability of the primary debtor does not arise at all, which in the case of minor does not arise at all, and therefore cannot be held liable on the guarantee given for default of a minor. What does that mean? A minor cannot do any transactions in banking. A minor may draw, endorse, or negotiate a check or a bill, but he cannot be held liable on such a check or a bill. He cannot be sued in respect of a bill accepted by him during his minority, but such a check or a bill will be a valid instrument and all other parties will be liable in their respective capacities. Only the minor's part will be excluded, whereas all other parties who are connected with the check or a bill endorsement will be held liable. And just because a minor was one of the parties in between the endorsement will make no invalidity to that particular instrument. Minor can be appointed as a partner as well as an agent, but what would be the consequences? A minor can be admitted to the benefits of partnership with the consent of all the partners, but he will not be liable for the losses or debts of the firm. A minor may be appointed as an agent to act on behalf of his principal, but he cannot be held responsible to the principal, as we have seen in the previous slides. The banker should ascertain the return authority from the principal. This is very important. The return authority from the principal, and what should be the return authority for? The return authority regarding the power and the extent to which the minor agent is allowed to transact on behalf of the principal. The banker should be very clear what power and to what extent the minor will have to operate and follow with those authority given by the principal. What are the legal provisions regarding the guardianship of a minor? Because we have seen different types of guardians for a minor: a natural guardian, a testamentary guardian, guardian appointed by the court. So we can categorize the guardian of a minor into three main types. The first one is a natural guardian, which means the parent who has given the birth. The testamentary guardian, which may come out of a will. And the finally, if there is no provision of any guardian, the court may appoint a guardian. So these are the three important categorization of a guardian of a minor. Natural guardian. Section 6 of Hindu Minority and Guardianship Act 1956 says that or a minor boy or an unmarried girl, the father would be the guardian, and after him the mother shall be the guardian. When we say guardian, here it is the natural guardian, because these parents have given birth to the boy, minor boy, or the unmarried girl. The moment the girl gets married, who becomes a natural guardian for her? The husband of the married girl shall be called as a natural guardian. The term father or mother does not include the stepfather or the stepmother. This is to be noted. If the father becomes a sannyasi or does not remain a Hindu, he does not remain as a natural guardian. If the father is alive and is not removed from the guardianship, if the father is alive and not removed from the guardianship, the mother does not become a natural guardian. Who is a testamentary guardian? A Hindu father is entitled to act as the natural guardian of the minor legitimate children, may by will appoint a guardian for any of them in respect of the minor's persons or property. So a testamentary guardian will be a person who is appointed as the minor's guardian on the basis of a will made by the natural guardian, and such guardians act only after the death of the father or the mother. So this testamentary guardian comes into the picture only after the death of the natural guardians. Sometimes the court also appoints the guardian of a minor under the Guardians and Wards Act 1890. Welfare of the minor becomes the top priority, and hence the welfare of a minor shall be a paramount consideration of the court while appointing such a guardian, because the court is really concerned about how the minor will come up in life if he doesn't have any guiding factor to guide him and bring him up. So there is a special provisions made in the Guardians and Wards Act 1890 in which the father or the husband in case of a married girl is exclusively entitled to be the guardian. Court may not be authorized to appoint or declare a guardian of the person of a minor if his father is alive and is not, in the opinion of the court, unfit to be a guardian of the person of a minor. So in this case, the court cannot appoint a guardian if the father is alive and is still fit to provide the necessities to the minor. This holds good too in the case of a minor girl whose husband is not, in the opinion of the court, unfit. So only if there is no way in which the minor can be nurtured, then the court steps in and appoints a guardian of that particular minor, and this comprises the third category of the guardian, which is a guardian appointed by the court. Because of the recent legislations, the mother has also been allowed to act as a natural guardian. The famous case of Geeta Hariharan and another versus the Reserve Bank of India, the Supreme Court has held that in all situations where the father is not in actual charge of the affairs of the minor, either because of his indifference or because of an agreement, and the minor is in exclusive care and custody of the mother, or the father by any reason is unable to take care of the minor, under such circumstances, the mother can act as a natural guardian of the minor. Reserve Bank of India, after this landmark decision given by Supreme Court, has advised banks to permit opening of a minor's account with the mother as a natural guardian also. Now we move on to a next category, which is an adult, which clearly means above 18 years of age. An adult is a person who is not a minor. An adult may open an account in his own name. The bank should take precautions to ensure that the account is not opened in a fictitious name. He should be very clear whose account he is opening, and if he is going to open an account in the name of an adult, he has to take his identity proofs, his address proofs, and only then he can open an account in his name and not in any fictitious names which is not backed by any documents of identity or address proof. It's not just sufficient to take the documents. A banker has to make checks to satisfy himself that a person is whom he claims to be. We have some serious frauds in which the documents are manipulated. The banker has to apply his mind whether such document really pertains to him, whether the photographs that are put on it really purpose to such person. So such application of mind is necessary over and above the submission of documents which establishes the identity of any person intending to open an account with the bank. This is very important from the banker's point of view. Senior citizens. In normal terms, a senior citizen is an adult who is 60 years old or more. Some entities consider it as 65 years also. But the point over here is, whenever a person is declared as a senior citizen based on his age criteria, bankers offer them higher rates of interest in certain schemes. So if you see the rate chart of the banks, they will have two distinct rates. One is for the normal individual and one is for the senior citizens. Senior citizens will be offered a slightly higher rate of interest, maybe 0.25 to about 1% more than the normal rates of interest offered to the general public. This is a special provision made for offering some sort of incentives to the senior citizens who by that age don't have any additional source of income. By the time they are already retired and they actually live on the interest income based on the deposits they have earned in their lifetime. And hence this is a special incentive passed on to the senior citizens by offering higher rate of interest. And hence it becomes very essential for the banker to confirm that a person who is claiming to be a senior citizen is indeed a senior citizen, and that confirmation can come only with the help of a birth proof, date of birth proof, which establishes his age, and only after that he will be eligible for claiming the incentives specifically meant for the senior citizens. So it is important that prior to offering these schemes, that steps be taken to determine whether the person is in actual fact a senior citizen. The verification can be done by checking the individual's birth certificate or a passport or any other document which establishes his age and considered to be a valid document by the bank as per its rules and regulations. So these are the things that one banker has to follow while opening an account of a senior citizen. Most of the girls, either minor or major, have an account with the bank. In case of minor girls, the account is opened by the natural guardians, whereas an adult girl can have account in her own name. The point of discussion arises, what happens after her marriage? What happens to the account existing in her maiden name? And just because an account exists in her maiden name, she cannot open a new account in her married name. What are the provisions regarding the married woman? Marriage does not affect her separate estate known as the Stridhan. In case of Hindu married woman, she can open a bank account in her own name separate from her husband and can operate it freely, considering the entire money pertains to her. In case of a debt taken by a married woman, her husband can be liable in the following cases. That is, number one, if the loan is taken with his consent, and secondly, the debt is taken for supply of necessities of life and the husband defaults in supplying this to her. Before we actually consider these aspects of the liability of a husband, let us first understand the documents that are to be taken from the married woman. The marriage certificate is the biggest evidence of the happening of a marriage. So that becomes a prime document for submission. Secondly, if at all there is a change of name of the married woman, the evidence will come only in the form of a gazette notification, and hence a copy of a gazette notification becomes a prime evidence for considering the change name. Another evidence can come in the form of the name change on the passport, the name change on the PAN card. All these evidences comes in the form of allowing the banker to allow the married woman to open an account in the new name, that is the married woman's new name. What happens to the old accounts which existed in the maiden name? It can continue to exist, And such woman can continue to operate her account in her old name, provided the income which is accrued to her in her new name will not be able to go into that old name, and hence the necessity of opening a new account in her new name, so that whatever new accruals come because of her new name can be deposited in her new name bank account. Now we consider this very important context in which the person is who she claims to be. The status of married woman is governed by Married Women's Property Act 1874 and the Indian Succession Act 1925. The banker should make sufficient inquiry at the time of opening a separate account, satisfying himself that a person is she who claims to be, especially when the married woman may continue to hold account in her maiden name and wants to open an account in her married name. So what is required over here is, if she wants to open her account in a married name, then she has to submit all those documents which establishes her new name, which can be in the form of your gazette notification, the passport made in the new name, and other regulations which are actually forced or implemented by the banker.